WGN.
Hello, everybody. Karen Conti here. One of the last shows in the Showcase studio here on a beautiful summer evening. Roger, it's so nice to have you next to me. I didn't even know that you had the bottom half. I always just see the top half of you.
I'm just this floating spirit in the TV camera.
It's really nice to
have
you right
here. It's good
to
be here with you.
Now, Roger, I have to ask you, do you like doing all these like 5Ks and 10Ks? Are you like a weekend warrior?
I have never run a K in my life. I have always wanted to, and one of these days I will.
Well, I'm a big runner and a big athlete on the weekends, but I have to tell you, for those of you who are not, I want to alert you to June 9th in Seattle, Washington, there is the Lard Butt 1K.
That's mine, right there.
For below average athletes and weekend warriors. So it's a 1K, which is about 1,000 yards, and basically you can walk or run or do whatever you want. You just have to get up off the couch. It has donut stations every 250 meters.
It'll take me a day to get through the course.
And you have a well-stocked beer garden before and after, and it's put on by a football player who donates all the proceeds to a food bank.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Doesn't it sound great?
It's awesome.
I almost feel like flying out there for that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Don't make me walk all the way.
No, I won't. Anyway, we have a great show. We're going to be talking about morality clauses, and then about 7:30, we're going to talk about addiction. They say that about half of all people have somebody in their family history who has a serious addiction. We have opioid addiction, Adderall addiction, of course, other drugs and alcohol. And we're going to be talking to Michael Giamanco at Hazleton. And Hazleton is the Betty Ford Clinic. And we'll be talking about how to recognize the signs of addiction, how rehab happens, and why is it that we're having such a crisis here with opioids. And then, of course, at 8 o'clock, I'll be taking your legal questions on any topic at all. I'm going to give you the numbers now, but we won't be doing that until about 8 o'clock. Put it in your phone, 312-981-7200. Well, this week, there was an Ambien-induced tweet from Roseanne Barr, which resulted in the cancellation of her very popular show, and apparently she was making $1 million per episode, and many of the cast members lost their jobs. The likely legal mechanism making all of this possible, the morality clause. We've heard about it, and now we're going to talk about it. And with us today is Jeff Becker, the chair of Chicago's Swanson, Martin, and Bell. And he's the head of the entertainment and law practice. Welcome.
Hi, Karen. Nice to have you here.
So nice. And it's so funny because is it true that you are the lawyer for the band who was just in here?
I actually am, yes. I do work with Carly and Martina. It was quite fun to see them in here right before me.
That's great. And you have worked with Chance the Rapper?
I have.
Interesting. Very interesting. We'll talk a little bit more about what it's like to be an entertainment lawyer. But I want to get right to the issue of morality clauses. Can you tell our listeners, what is a morality clause?
Morality clause has its basis in protecting brand recognition of a company, right? So you'll have a company who hires an individual who has some sort of notoriety to them already, either to sponsor some sort of brand, to be on a television show, to be an artist in some manner, connected with the company. And what the company does is they add a provision to their contract that says if you act in a certain way, that could be a very objective thing, where if you are convicted of a crime, if you act in a manner that brings disrepute or a lack of positive brand recognition to our company, we have the right to terminate our contract.
So if you are representing the artist, you obviously want to make these things as specific as possible, I would guess, because you want to give your clients some parameters, I would imagine. When things are too amorphous and too kind of unpredictable, would that possibly lead to a dispute as to whether or not that morality clause was actually breached?
Well, yeah. The beauty of contracts generally is that they bring certainty to the relationship between the parties. You have the opportunity, when you're getting into the relationship, to define the parameters of that relationship. Obviously, if the provision that you're looking to is vague or lacks objectivity, it's going to create a lot of issues between the parties when that issue comes up later. So with morality clauses in particular, absolutely, you want to have as much objectivity and clarity as to how that provision is going to work and what would be required to actually invoke it to terminate that individual, that celebrity, that artist, under the terms of that contract.
So when you negotiate these things, I mean, and I'm not going to ask you to read one or to, but paraphrase, and you did say some of this, to bringing the organization into disrepute or are being convicted of a crime. But other than that, what other kinds of language do you put in there to kind of make it a little bit more solid and give the artist the heads up that if you do this, you're going to be canned?
Certainly. Well, so some of the language often looks like this. Anything that you do that will tend to shock or insult or offend the community or public morals or decency or prejudice the producer or the company in general, that's the provision as it looks typically when it comes from the company. What we try to do at that point is claw back on anything that's general, that's subjective, that would allow us to bring more definitiveness to what has to happen. Often what we're looking at are things involving crimes, right? If someone's alleged to have acted in a certain way, we, representing the individual, don't typically like that. We like it to be something that's done through a conviction, right? Or something that goes through an arbitration process where somebody actually determines if the allegations are true. The place that you might have seen morality clauses come up even more recently in the last year or so is with the Me Too movement.
Obviously, right.
Yeah. Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, all of these different situations have come up, which have caused, in the film industry, producers to look much closer at the morality clauses they're invoking with their artists.
And this is putting everybody in a very difficult spot because, as you say, an allegation shouldn't mean that it ends your career. However, an allegation could be just as harmful as a conviction or a lawsuit or a payment or a settlement. So it's interesting that these allegations can be made and people's whole careers can be really shot when there's really no proof of it. And I think that offends a lot of people.
It does. It does. But you have to understand, obviously, that once these allegations come out, it starts clouding so much the relationship between that celebrity or that individual and the brand, the producer, whoever it might be on the other side. For the sake of today, I'll just say the employer. And that could be anybody, the brand, the producer, the record label, whoever it might be. When the employer is finding themselves so much entwined in defending what the individual has done that it's distracting from the value of the brand itself, they often have to make a decision to separate themselves from that individual, for better or worse. And they know this going into it, right?
I mean,
the idea is when you're getting into a relationship with the employer, if you're representing the artist, you need to make sure the artist understands there are certain things, if they come up, are going to be an issue. And interestingly, one of the major parts of these provisions people look at today is whether the misconduct, the alleged misconduct, happened after that contract was signed or before. In the case of Kevin Spacey, for example,
right,
most of these allegations involve things that happened years ago. It doesn't change the fact that when you look at what Netflix has had to do, they parted ways with him because it's pulling so far in the direction now that they would be defending his actions that kept him on, even though those actions happened years before House of Cards even existed.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show, and Jeff Becker is an entertainment lawyer here in Chicago, and we're talking about morality clauses. If you have a question, please give us a call, 312-981-7200. Karen Conti here, and we're talking to entertainment lawyer Jeff Becker about morality clauses and some of the things that have been in the news lately. The history of morality clauses is kind of an interesting one. Can you kind of give us a quick summary of your knowledge of what that history is?
Yeah, the morality clauses kind of derive out of the 1920s. There was a party at Fatty Arbuckle's home, a celebrity at that time, and someone had died, and there were allegations of rape and murder, and even though he wasn't necessarily directly involved in it, it became a situation that the producers found themselves defending against over and over and over again. And after that time, Universal Music, I believe it was, or Universal Studios, was the first company to really put into a contract a provision that said, if you're involved, even if it's not you directly, but if you're involved in a situation that brings public disrepute to us, that causes issues for us and our brand, we have the right to terminate our relationship.
You know, I just think of some of these artists who want to stretch or push the envelope, I guess I should say, like the Samantha Bees and even Roseanne Barr. I mean, she's an outspoken person, and she says things that are outrageous. But where, you know, how do you draw the line here? And someone gave an example the other day about how when you remember All in the Family, and if you're old, of a certain age, you remember that television show, right, where he was kind of a racist and he was kind of a blue-collar guy and he'd say all kinds of things that were inappropriate. But you kind of knew that he was playing a character and that Carol O'Connor himself was an educated theater, fine actor, and he was portraying somebody as a caricature almost. And so you wouldn't take offense to the things that he said on camera. But where does the line get drawn if you are hired as an actor to kind of push that envelope?
Well, if you're hired as an actor to push the envelope, that's one thing. If you're not hired for that purpose, that's a completely different situation. Sam B, you know, had her career started with The Daily Show, and she was part of this comedic pressing the envelope on a political
right.
spectrum level. That's what the purpose was behind her being hired by Comedy Central, pushing the envelope further. Now, Roseanne Barr is a character. Everyone knows her as being, you know, from a right-wing perspective, someone to push the envelope outside of a show. She was hired, however, as an actor to put together a show, the Roseanne, you know, show, that isn't necessarily supposed to be focused on politics. And even then, when you look at the statements that she made, those statements were extremely derogatory from an objective standpoint, right? Samantha Bee didn't speak in a racist fashion. She didn't speak in that manner. She spoke in a way that perhaps people didn't like, certainly when it came to how she described the subject of that statement.
I would call it gender. It was offensive from a gender standpoint, because using the
sure.
C word to me is a gender slur.
You know, and that's interesting, because at the end of the day, you have to look at, my opinion,
sure.
How brands are impacted by it, what they're doing. You know, both sides of that situation, whether it's Roseanne or Sam B, you had sponsors pulling their sponsorships from,
sure.
from the shows. And the stations needed to decide, the networks needed to decide what they want to do. Comedy Central knew getting into this with Sam B, that's what they want her to do. They're not going to walk away from that. And quite honestly, it probably isn't a breach of her contract. Whereas I haven't seen the contract with Roseanne Barr, ABC probably had other provisions in there, and the morality clauses are often linked to what your job and responsibility is, right?
Right.
If you're going to get into a situation with a bad boy, right? You know, there are certain sponsors that walked away from Ryan Lochte after he went through the Olympics and had lied all about where he was partying that night. A new sponsor came along later on that said, hey, we want to sponsor you and have you endorse our brand because we believe in redemption. Right?
Right.
And so that situation is completely different than the ones we're looking at here.
So I had a thought that you have all of these people who were staff members and other actors in the show. They said there were about 200 of them who are now out of work, or maybe will be out of work because of what Roseanne Barr said. Would they have a possible lawsuit against Roseanne? So the idea would be that Roseanne owed them a duty to be a, you know, follow her morality clause, not violate it. And because she did that, and she did it in such a way that she should have known that it was foreseeable if she said something obnoxious, like she said, that the show would go away and all of these people would be out of work. Is that
a stretch? It's an interesting proposition. I'd say it's a little bit of a stretch.
Yep.
But you know what? That's what we as lawyers have to do sometimes,
that's
and
right.
it's not clear on the face. The larger actors on the show are going to be just fine. They have contracts with ABC, and those contracts are essentially pay or play. They're going to get paid anyway.
Okay.
Right? So they're not going to have an issue, most of them. There are hundreds of staff members who will. And the way that ABC is looking at this, at least, is likely what we're all talking about right now, is this is a force majeure. Roseanne, going off the hinges on Twitter, was a force majeure outside the control of ABC. We have the right to cancel the contract whenever we want to. So they're likely going to be out of luck, at least with respect to the producer and the contract they had with their employer. With Roseanne, I think it would be amazing to watch somebody put together a lawsuit that went after her for some sort of breach of duty. Perhaps negligence? I
yeah.
don't know.
Interesting.
Obviously, they don't have a contractual relationship with her directly, so that might be a tough one to press.
Yeah, interesting. Let's switch over to Sesame Street. There was a lawsuit brought, I believe it was last week. Some of the Sesame Street, the owner of the brand, brought a suit against the producers of the Melissa McCarthy's film, Happy Time Murders, because the film uses the tagline, "No Sesame, All Street." Apparently, it's kind of a raunchy show with puppets that look very much like the Sesame Street puppets. In fact, they were created by the son of the creators of the Sesame Street puppets. And I heard that it was dismissed this week. Can you talk a little bit about the basis for this lawsuit and why Sesame Street would bring such a lawsuit to enforce its apparent rights?
So let's just back up for a moment. The case was not actually dismissed.
Okay.
And I've looked into this quite a bit as of recent as well. Everyone seems to report it as being dismissed.
Yeah.
What actually happened was a TRO motion, a motion for immediate relief, was filed by Sesame Street.
Stop using my words.
Right?
Yeah, okay.
And let's just talk about what the case is actually about. What happened is, and you're right, it's raunchy times six, right? Mm-hmm. That's what this is. It's puppets having sex and puppets killing each other and puppet detectives trying to find out who killed the other puppets, right? It is similar to Meet the Feebles from back in the day or Avenue Q on Broadway. You know, Sesame Street on crack is how I always describe those. Hopefully I don't get sued for trademark infringement now. That's what the case was really about. It's trademark infringement. Sesame Street owns the brand Sesame Street, right? The owners of that company own the brand Sesame Street. And when you own a brand name like Sesame Street and someone's using it in a way that either causes... Really, the fundamental factor is there a likelihood of confusion between how somebody else is using that name and our affiliation with how they're using it? Does it look to the public like we're endorsing that use, that we're the sponsor or the originator of that use, or is their use diluting our brand in some way? Is someone, for example, making a cookie and calling it Keebler when it's not Keebler and it's a really crappy cookie, right?
Right.
Now it's ruining our brand. That's what Sesame Street had really an issue with. And it wasn't the movie. Sesame Street made it very clear. We're not suing to stop the movie from coming out. We don't have a problem with the puppets. Our real issue is the fact that they used the phrase, "No Sesame, All Street," on the print ads as well as in the trailer. And what they wanted to do was stop the trailer from going further. When they filed a motion asking for the trailer to immediately be pulled down, the judge said no. That is a sign of where it might go.
Yes.
Later, the judge is saying it looks like you might not have a really great case. At least today I can't give you your immediate relief. They're back in court this month, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Very interesting, because I kind of had a feeling that the case had merit, because the puppets did look like the Sesame Street puppets. You're using the name Sesame, using the name Street, and people could be confused that this might be something that's sponsored by a wholesome brand, and it's certainly
sure.
Not everything but wholesome.
But it's interesting, right? Because when I look at it, the first thing I look at is it's No Sesame, right?
Right.
No Sesame, All Street. And when you're looking at whether the public's going to be confused as to whether the Sesame Street owners are actually involved in this, it almost on its face looks like there's a departure from the original brand. That they're saying this is not Sesame Street. This
right.
is Puppets on Crack.
You're right. Okay, we have 10 seconds for this answer to a very big question.
Sure.
What is a copyright and what is a trademark?
The trademark is a phrase that's used to identify a brand to the public. Nike, just do it. The swoosh. A copyright is a bundle of rights that protect something that you've created, like a musical song, a book, or a movie. Completely separate rights, in both property of the mind, but in a different way.
Jeffrey Becker, thank you so much for joining us. How can people contact you if they are, like for instance me, like I want to be a star and I want you to bring me through the process? That was really a nervous laugh.
Thank you. They're welcome to go to our website at www.smbtrials.com. S as in Sam, M as in Mary, B as in boy, trials.com. They can also email me at jbecker@smbtrials.com, or they can call the office at 312-321-9100.
Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us. You'll come again, I'm sure.
Of course, absolutely.
Okay, take care. Remember, I'll be taking your calls after 8 o'clock, 312-981-7200, on any legal issue you might have. Is it a family law issue, a criminal law issue, or is it something that you noticed in the news and you have a legal question about that, or any question at all? I'm happy to help you. 981-7200. Listen to the statistics on the issue of addiction. Over 28 million Americans age 12 or older have a substance abuse disorder involving alcohol, illicit drugs, or even prescription medicines. And that's about 1 out of 10. 30% of all people with mental illness have abuse issues, and it is estimated that addiction costs our country $600 billion a year. It's no exaggeration to say that everybody knows somebody who has an addictive disorder. And here to discuss the issue of addiction is Michael Giamanco. Michael has has a master's in counseling and the psychology of addiction. He is a licensed certified alcohol and drug counselor and is a patient placement counselor at the Hazel and Betty Ford Clinic here in Chicago. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Karen.
So nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Okay, let's talk about addiction. Is it a thin line between if you're an addict or not? What are the, I guess, the qualifications to diagnose somebody as having an addiction issue?
Well, my role at Hazel and Betty Ford, I'm an intake counselor.
Okay.
So I'm the first person they see when they walk in the door, and it's my job to evaluate whether or not they're abusing a substance, dependent on a substance, and we determine that based on how is the using of their drinking, their smoking marijuana, whatever it might be, how's that affecting their everyday life? Is it affecting their relationship with their spouse, with their family, their work life? Are they going in late? Are they drinking two glasses of wine a couple days a week, or are they drinking a bottle of wine 7 days a week? In that case, they're probably going to come to Hazel and Betty Ford to ask for help. So I like to say that people who think they might have a problem possibly do, because those who don't think about that, it might not cross their mind. But if they're thinking, you know, I'm drinking quite a bit or I'm smoking too much weed, the fact that it's crossed their mind probably is a good indication that they're overdoing it, and the other consequences as well.
Michael, if you, for our listeners out there who know somebody, someone close to them, a spouse or a child or a relative or a neighbor that they suspect has problems and maybe is in denial about it and not addressing it, and they can see that it's causing problems. And again, you don't want to be a Budinsky, but what should a person do if they suspect that a loved one might have an issue? What are the best things to do?
I think it starts with communication. It's a key word in the addiction field, and if we don't talk about it, nothing's going to happen. So I myself am in recovery. I got sober 14 years ago.
Congratulations.
In my 40s, and should have done it in my 30s. I knew for a long time I had an issue, and my family would bring it up to me, but they also kind of brought it up gently at times because they hoped I would come to that realization where I would stop. Families should bring it up to a family member in a gentle way, but they're coming from a place of love, and the person who's abusing the substances hopefully will hear that. They may be defensive and not ready to hear that yet. I know until I was ready to stop drinking and using cocaine, I wasn't going to. And so it had to be something I was willing to take that step with. So communication, it's the key. Talk to your family member about it.
So you hear this a lot where someone has to hit rock bottom before they go to rehab, and I hear that mantra all the time. Is that a fair statement when it comes to dealing with people with addiction? Does there have to be or is there often, I should say, a precipitating factor like a divorce or a DUI or something that tells a person, I got a problem?
There certainly can be. You know, it can be that DUI. It can be the spouse saying, you know what, you need to move out until you stop drinking. It could be losing a job. There's different levels of rock bottom. We talk about in my field, just how low does your bottom have to go? And hopefully it doesn't have to go way down there, but bottoms can go pretty deep. I've seen middle bottoms, and I've seen people then go to that next bottom. They might come in for a program, for a Hazel and program, and get sober for months and have a relapse and come back after another bottom has entered their lives. So usually there's something that's going to happen that's opened up their eyes to say, yeah, I do need to look at this.
And the people that lapse, is that fairly common? I mean, I suppose it depends on what kind of addiction and a number of other factors, but would you say it's a common thing that people have a relapse?
More common than we'd hope.
Yeah.
And yet someone can use a relapse as a tool to help them in their journey of recovery and moving forward. We'd like to say it's not required to relapse when you're in recovery, but a lot of people do. I mean, I had my share of two or three, and when I went back into recovery and into a program, I had a better foundation that was already there, and I had learned something. 50% of the people can relapse, you know. It's one of those things where if they're not diligent about their recovery and putting it first in front of everything else, they're going to lose the other things, and they could have a relapse. So they've got to want it, and they've got to realize, you know what, that one drink, probably not a good idea. Some people are going to try it, though they might have 20 years sober. They go back out.
Mm. So if you look at the people that succeed in rehab eventually and with some relapses, because, you know, the goal is to ultimately get sober, what are the characteristics that help people through rehab and get sober, and what are the characteristics that bring people down and prevent them from getting better?
I think the key element of getting sober is involving yourself in some type of fellowship with others in recovery. That could be AA. It could be Hazel and Betty Ford. It could be group therapy like we offer. It could be just doing something healthy for your life. You know, our program, I like to sum it up in two words, and recovery in two words. It's about self-care, you know, where people are normally not taking care of themselves when they drink and smoke and use drugs the way they do. It's a matter of changing some things in your lifestyle and being diligent about those things. But a key element is the social aspect and having a group of sober social peers and reaching out to them and realizing I don't have to do this alone.
And I know that sounds trite, and I'm maybe begging the question, but why does that help? I mean, is it just that you're accountable to somebody, that you are on the same wavelength, that they understand what you're going through, and therefore they feel the compassion, and that helps them? I mean, or a combination of those things?
I think combination, but I like to describe addiction as it's a disease of isolation. You know, when I used at the end, I wasn't drinking at the bars. I was drinking alone in my basement or in my bathroom, hiding it from my family, and being opening up those doors and not having that second, you know, almost having a double life is not what addicts are used to doing. So learning to do that, communicating, not isolating, it's key. It makes you accountable.
And one final question before we take a break here. And by the way, if anyone has a comment or a question for Michael, I'm sure he would love to answer it. 312-981-7200. I'm very happy that you have shared your experience with us a little bit. Does it help you as a counselor? And you tell your patients, listen, I had this problem. This was my problem, and this is what I did for a number of years, and this is how I hit rock bottom, and this is what it took for me to get where. Does that give you credibility with them that matters?
It certainly doesn't hurt. Is it a prerequisite for someone in my profession? No. But having been there, having walked down those aisles, so to speak, there's a sense of I can trust this person, and I might open up a little bit more. And I'm looking at Michael saying, wow, you were using cocaine and drinking every day of the week for 30 years. If you can do it, and now you're 14 years sober, maybe I can do that. My role, I want to give people hope. I believe anyone can get sober if they want it. That's the key. They have to want it. And so, you know, my sharing my story, I have to always realize it's not about me. It has to be about the other client, to the clients.
We're talking to Michael Giamanco, who's a patient placement counselor at Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation here in Chicago, and you're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
I tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been back, but when I come back, no.
We're talking to Michael Giamanco, who is with Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation here in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us. This is a topic that's so interesting to me as a lawyer. I was sharing with you a little bit before the show that drug addiction, alcohol addiction really cuts through my business, because a lot of people who commit crimes have issues with drugs and alcohol. A lot of people whose marriages are breaking up, who get fired from jobs, there is a relation between getting in trouble with the law and having legal issues and addiction issues. And I'm sure you have to deal with that side of it as well, because people who have serious addictions, you know, will have that additional problem, right? So let me ask you this. Opioids have become an epidemic, and the statistics are just overwhelming. They say that 115 people die each day due to opioid abuse. Are you seeing that at the clinic? Are you seeing the people who are addicted?
We're seeing quite a bit of it, and it's phenomenal how the population that we're seeing are young people, kids, I want to say, between the ages of 18 and 21, oftentimes females, they somehow try heroin, snorting it for the first time. And they use it a second time. And before you know it, they're injecting heroin. And a person who, you know, she was 18, maybe 19, and she used to smoke weed and maybe do something else and drink alcohol, not even interested in those things anymore. It's like, I don't drink, I do heroin. So I do a lot of assessments with young people who are addicted to heroin or prescription opioids. And it's devastating. And is it tougher than alcohol or weed or other things? You know, addiction is addiction, but something like heroin is going to kill you quicker, most likely.
Right, right.
I don't know any old heroin addicts.
Yeah.
You know, something happens to them, and they don't live into their 30s or 40s. So this epidemic, it's huge, and we're seeing a lot of it.
And I guess, you know, this is not quite your issue because you're focused more on patient well-being and getting them better. But I guess it astounds me that there's so much of this prescription medicine out there and available to people who don't have it prescribed to them. I suppose some of them have it prescribed to them, and then they get addicted. But there's some people who get it from others. And how does that work? And what do you see from a sociological standpoint that is exacerbating this issue?
You know, what I see with the prescribed medication is someone will hurt their knee or have surgery, and they'll start taking prescribed Norco or Vicodin, and they start to enjoy that. And before you know it, they're asking their doctor for another refill, but eventually those are going to stop. So what do? They resort to buying pills off the street. You know, you can buy a 30-milligram Vicodin pill or a Norco pill. It can cost you $30 a pill, and at that point, the addict might be taking 10, 20, 30 of those a day. So cost is unbelievable, and yet they're going to find a way to support that. I mean, and these can be very successful business people who are just spending an exorbitant amount of money, because if they stop using that many pills a day, they're going to go through some severe detox and withdrawal protocol. So they keep using, and their tolerance goes up and up and up. And so they can get it anywhere.
Do you think, I know, again, this is not your topic, but do you think there's going to be a change in the laws and change in the protocols and how these things are dispensed? Because what I see, and when I see people who are addicted to these things, like you said, they got it legitimately for an injury. You know, and for the most part, I don't know about anybody else, but if I had something that I had surgery, I take one, maybe I take the one the next day, and then I'm done. I don't want to take that stuff. It doesn't make me feel good. That's not my brand of entertainment. So what do you do with that bottle? And I guess some people sell it, or it gets found in someone's medicine cabinet and it goes to the wrong person. So should doctors have a different protocol on how to dispense this medicine?
In your view. I'd like to think that they will and are more cautious. I mean, I think there's unfortunately maybe some doctors out there that prescribe a little too freely, and some that are aware of this and are watching it more, because as you said, you'll take one or two and you're done with it. That's not your party. You know, for me, it'd be like, where's more? You know, I don't have an off switch when it comes to alcohol and drugs, and that's just the way I was wired, I guess.
We have a texter from the 224. Is dependence, it's dependence but addiction. People who genuinely need these on a daily basis are being denied these meds and then are unable to function. I don't know. Do you see that? I mean, you wouldn't see that. That wouldn't be. Those wouldn't be the people you see.
You know, I worked with someone recently, and she was prescribed chronic pain, and I'm the last person to say, you know, you shouldn't be prescribed that medication. But if someone's taking more than was originally needed, and they're overdoing it, I would just ask them, talk to a professional about this. You know, I'm not the doctor that can do this, but make sure you're not overdoing it and causing an exorbitant amount of problems down the line. But,
right.
You know, people do need pain medication.
Oh, absolutely.
They need to be careful, though.
Yeah, of course. I'm going to have to go to a caller here who has a question that I was going to ask you. Margaret, thank you for calling. What is your question for Michael?
Well, my question is, based on his personal experience and also professional experience, our concern with many of us is that our state of Illinois is wanting to use marijuana or pass laws so it can be used recreationally. Now, most people, I think, can understand accepting the use for medical purposes, but recreational use you know, we have concerns, and especially as a gateway drug, which the gentleman has explained, for people, you know, in fact, I know people that have worked in the field, social workers, teachers, and so on, psychologists. So what would his advice be and his concerns telling our state legislators?
Good question, Margaret. Thank you. Michael, what do you say about that? Is it a gateway drug?
It can be. I know I started with marijuana and eventually gave that up, and then cocaine and alcohol became my thing. You know, we're seeing it legalized in a number of different states. I think inevitably we're going to see that happen. And, I mean, alcohol is legal, and yet Hazel and Betty Ford works with a lot of people who are addicted to alcohol. There may be people who can use marijuana recreationally in a moderate way, but when it becomes legalized, I'm sure we're going to see more people misusing it, just like we do with alcohol. But I believe it's inevitable that it may go that route. I don't know that it'll happen too quickly in Illinois because the state legislators are kind of, you know, holding back. But I don't know that there's one simple answer for that.
And you don't have an opinion as to whether or not by legalizing it, you're going to maybe encourage people who normally wouldn't try it to try it.
You might. And yet you also might change some things where people are like, well, now it's legal. I can try it at some point, but I'm not as I don't feel as obligated to have to go out there and try it with a friend. I think, you know, the addict, the addictive personality, as you said about yourself earlier, Cameron, you know, that's, you've got that off switch. You're not really looking to go in that direction. Those who have that addictive personality and a penchant for abusing are probably going to move that direction anyway.
Yeah, and there's no statistics on whether or not the addiction to one drug makes you more prone to addiction to another drug, or has that been proven?
You know, I think the whole gateway concept, certainly trying certain things can lead to others, but we're seeing a lot of people who are only addicted to marijuana these days.
And, you know, interesting.
Weed nowadays, compared to when I smoked 25 years ago, it's a different ball game altogether. Just the intensity, the strength, and we're seeing people strictly, they don't drink, they don't do cocaine, heroin, it's marijuana. And it's a tough one to get off of. And there is
interesting, because like when I was a kid, that was not an addictive, it didn't seem to be as addictive as it is now. One final area I'd like to cover for people out there who are listening with children, and we have talked about how that works. What would be some tips for your children to watch them, to talk to them? What do you say to your kids, and what do you do for your kids? I know you have children. What do you say to them about these issues?
Again, I'm going to go back to the word communication. My boys were 10 years old and 6 years old when I got sober, and now they are 24 and 20. And, you know, they like to do their thing. We talk about recovery in my family. We talk about addiction. They've been to AA meetings with me. Talk to your kids. Trying to possibly prevent what might happen in high school and putting your foot down too hard, it might have that opposite effect where they're like, I'm going to go try this just to get back at mom and dad.
Right.
Whereas if you communicate with them saying, you know, you may be trying this, and I get that, but come and talk with me about it. Let's put some ground rules in place here, because communication is key, and letting your kids know, I'm there for you. I understand this. Maybe I've been there. Communicate. Put recovery on the table. Let's educate our kids and family members.
Thank you so much for joining us. Michael Giamanco, who's the placement counselor at Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation here in Chicago. If someone wants to get a hold of you or the Betty Ford Foundation, how would they do that?
They could try our 1-800 number, which is 1-800-257-7810. Our website is www.hazeldenbettyford.org. And I'm at our Chicago facility, 312-631-7935.
This is the time to get your legal questions in, or questions about anything you might have. 312-981-7200. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've been doing it for about 31 years, and I can maybe kind of lead you in the right direction or answer your question as best I can. If for some reason you can't get through or you would rather speak on a more private line, you can always call me at my office, 312-332-7800, and leave a message, or better yet, send me an email. And when you send me an email, tell me what your problem is. Usually it's better to tell me when it happened so I can make an assessment as to whether you still might have a valid cause of action or a lawsuit, and where you are, what county, because that will determine who I refer you to or if I know how things work in your particular area. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com. That's KarenConti.com. And we've got a bunch of callers, so I'm going to get right to them. Let's go to Steve. Hi, Steve. Welcome to WGN.
Hi. My question is, I live in Cook County. A lady upstairs from me had rented out her place to her son, and she had initially, when she went in, when she bought the place upstairs for me, she had insurance. She has since, 2 months ago, there was a leak from her hot water heater. It came down to my area. I was not there. By the time I got there, there was a lot of mold. I contacted my insurance company, and they said, we don't cover seepage or mold. You're out of luck. These people upstairs don't have insurance. The association says they're not liable. Naturally, because, you know, they did check at one point to make sure she had insurance, and she did, so I'm out. I've had estimates then going up to $15,000. It was quite extensive. I had to replace all the cabinets, all the appliances. It's just a mess in there.
Okay, so Steve, a couple of questions. Your condo association requires insurance, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the leak, was it a leak relating to a defect in the condo above you, or was it a leak in the common area?
Well, the leak was right above me. It came down to the walls.
Okay.
They have buckets in the hallway, which is adjacent to my kitchen and my bath. So all that water came into the brick and saturated, inside.
And one final question. Why did your insurance carrier, what was the basis for denying coverage?
They don't cover mold.
So did they cover remediating the water and taking the water out?
They said they would do that. They would give me $5,000.
Okay, but the rest of the $10,000 has to do with mold remediation, correct?
It's mold remediation. It's replacing cabinets. It's replacing all dishwashers and, the sink, everything underneath.
Okay. And just one, I guess, one final question is, did you look at the insurance policy or did you talk to your agent to make sure that they are correct that mold is not covered?
Yes, I did check with my insurance agent. He said they are only covered for $5,000.
Okay. So here's the situation. Just because they don't have insurance doesn't mean that you can't sue them. Because if they're responsible for the leak, then they are responsible for all of the foreseeable consequences. Those are the words we use as lawyers. And certainly, if water is going to trickle down in the walls, that mold is obviously a foreseeable consequence. The problem when you don't have insurance is that means you will then have to sue them. The amount of money is probably not enough to warrant hiring a lawyer, so you're going to probably have to do this on your own, which if you are so inclined, you can do it, and you can file a complaint for negligence and property damage, and you can ask for the full cost of what the remediation is. Then you'd have to get your records together, you'd have to get your mold people together, and you'd put together a packet that shows exactly what needs to be done and how much it will have to cost, and you can sue them. And you would sue the kid who lives there and probably the owner of the unit as well. Before you spend all that time and energy doing that, I would put it together and send a letter and say, this is what it cost, this is what I demand, and we'd like to settle this with you, but if I can't settle it, then I'm going to have to bring a suit. In fact, you might even want to hire a lawyer to send that letter so that it comes from a lawyer, and maybe they would be a little bit more intimidated into doing the right thing, which is to step up to the plate and pay what the damage is. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
There's one other problem with this. 4 days ago, I took the gentleman who lives upstairs into my unit and let him hear water dripping into my kitchen on the ceiling.
Okay.
Today there is still water dripping. The association says, well, we've tried to contact a plumber and a roofing specialist and all these people to come out. We haven't had anyone yet to come out. And I'm like, okay, so I still have water coming in. I've already started making repairs. And I just see me having to undo everything I've just done.
No,
and
I get
start
it.
Over again.
All right, I'm going to put you on hold because I want to get to the next caller. But I just want to say that this is something that, you know, you might need to involve a lawyer at this point, and you might need to involve a lawyer to go to talk to the association, send a letter to the association, and get tough with them, because this might be a situation that's more than a $15,000 issue. Because you're right, if you remediate it and the water's still trickling down there, you're going to have an ongoing problem with this, and the association really needs to help you with this to enforce your rights or fix it. And I think that the more homework that you do in a situation like this, the better, meaning get your construction people out there, see if they can identify what the nature of the problem is, and then you can say to the condo association, this is originating from here. This is what you need to do. And hopefully you can resolve it that way. It sounds like a bad situation, and I don't envy you. Give us a call here at 981-7200. Stacy, why don't you hold on? I'm going to take a quick break here, but when I come back, I want to take your call. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show, and we're taking your legal questions.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who is against the law?
Get in your legal questions. I'm happy to answer as best I can. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Stacy. Hi, Stacy. Welcome to WGN.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your legal question?
Okay, my legal question is that I've hired an electrician to rewire my home, and it's a small one-man company, but he's licensed and totally acceptable to have do this project, and I hired him back in January, and we had some issues because we had a house fire, so we had a few issues getting funding and getting checks, et cetera, from the insurance company, but we finally got that straightened out. Then my electrician had some health issues, so then he wasn't able to start when he wanted to start, but finally we got started and things started happening, and my house is about half rewired. And then my electrician went and took a full-time job out of state.
Ugh.
And now I cannot get in touch with him. He has not been back to my house in weeks. At one point he did tell me after I tried to reach out to him that he was home for 2 days and he drove by my house, but nobody was there.
Okay.
We were not living in the house.
Okay, just
and like- then.
Go ahead. I don't need all the details, but the bottom line is he still needs to do half of the job, correct?
Right.
Now, the question,
I don't know what to do.
The question is, did you pay him for all of it?
No, we paid him for a portion of it.
Okay. Well, why can't you just hire somebody new now and finish up the job and then pay him from the insurance proceeds remaining?
Well, because number one, I feel like we've paid him for more than the work that's been completed.
Okay.
Number two, I've tried to call several different electrical people to come out
okay.
and do what you said, but they said honestly, you should try to just work with the electrician you have because it would take them so much time to figure out what has
okay.
been done.
All right.
Versus what needs to be done.
Okay. So, you know, this is one of those, questions that doesn't have a super legal answer because involving a lawyer is going to cost you more than what this whole job would cost. But, you know, I guess I would just try to be nice to this guy and say, you know, I need you to come here and finish it, whether it's on a weekend or whether you need to take time off your job. Please, you know, just, you know, implore him to do the right thing. That's probably the best bet. And then you can say that you're going to need to sue him if he can't come out and do it, because where he left off may not be something that another electrician can come and, like you said, come and pick it up and do it. The bottom line is you don't want to throw, you know, bad money after good money. Sorry, good money after bad money, I should say. So I think that, you know, trying those things, it sounds like you're already trying those things, and then you might just have someone step in and have to finish it and pay a little bit more. You know, let me just talk a little bit about construction projects, because it's that time of year. Everyone is trying to fix up their homes, and they're interested in, you know, hiring construction people. And I'm not blaming you, Stacy. It sounds like you did your due diligence, and the person probably was a good electrician. But what kind of electrician just leaves a job and walks away and goes to another state? I mean, that's just wrong. He should have finished it up, and he should have gone and done the right thing. I don't know if you could have done that by better due diligence. I don't know if the Better Business Bureau has records on him. I don't know if there's a Yelp on him, probably not. He's probably a small guy. But this is the kind of thing you really, really need to always be careful and make sure you never pay anybody more than they're in little bits at a time. And if there's ever materials that you need to buy them yourself directly. Do not give a construction person money to go to Lowe's, because that person could take it and pocket it and walk away. And I see it all the time, especially with very expensive things like windows and cabinets, where you're shelling out maybe $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for something, and you've just given him money and he's nowhere to be found. And these are people too, it's not like they're necessarily bad people, but maybe they have financial issues and maybe they got caught up in something, and it's not something that, you know, you have any control over, but the control is the money and the control is the due diligence. Because once this happens, you know, it's a bad situation, because, like I said, throwing your money away on lawyers and the time is just probably not worth it. We have a question from the 847 area code on the texting. Question is, do I need to do a Liz Pendens lien in Will County to receive this award? Or where would I find the lien already sent to my ex? Thanks so much. Okay, this is a long question. Okay, I was just awarded a judgment of child support. I found my child. Okay, the person got an arrearage award, meaning arrearage is child support was owed. So there was a judgment entered against the ex-husband, and she found out that my ex was awarded $10,000 for workers' comp in an injury. I believe Illinois put the lien on the award because my ex came to court refusing to accept the lien. I can't find it online. The question is, do I need to put the lien on to receive the award? Okay. Let me just, I don't know the exact answer to it, because I would need about 10 more facts here to understand it. But once you get a judgment, you don't get the money right away. People seem to think that. So you have to lien things, meaning you lien a house, which means that if the person sells the house, you will get your money, or you lien a car, or you garnish wages, which means when the paycheck comes, you get a portion of the wages, or a bank account. You put a garnishment on a bank account, which means the bank then turns over money to you to satisfy that lien. Here, it sounds like the ex-husband has a workers' compensation judgment or a settlement that's coming down the pike, so that's $10,000. So there's an ability to lien that before he gets it, but you would have to do it the right way and make sure that it's done properly. And I don't know if you would be sending that to the attorney who is going to get that money, or you're going to send it to the employer who is going to give the money to the lawyer. So that's something that you probably, it would be worth talking to a collection lawyer, someone who knows about these types of things in Will County, and I know somebody actually out there. So texter, please give me a call, or better yet, email me, and I will try to give you that referral so that person can help you out. So that's WGN at AskKarenConti.com. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. There was a question I'm not sure I know the answer to this, but it's a law question. I live in the suburbs, and the suburb where I live reserves the right to send an ordinance inspector onto private property to check for property violation, like gutters and grass, etc. Is that legal without a warrant? So the answer to your question is, I'm pretty sure that because they're a government, they're a municipality, they have the right to come on your property. I don't think they have the right to go into your house, but they do have the right to come onto your property to do inspections. And this is something that is probably what we call an easement, which means that the government can come on to make sure that you are not violating whatever ordinances there are. Now, how intrusive it is, like, can they come up onto your porch and can they open doors and windows and shutters? My guess would be no, but my good legal guess would be that they, yes, can come onto your property and observe things about your property to make sure that you're not violating. But if you'd like me to give you a further answer, I probably would like to know what suburb it is, and maybe I can give you a more specific answer. And that's, again, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. I've got phone lines open, 981-7200. I got a text a couple of weeks ago from the 708 area code. I am the mother of a child who is an adult, but she is severely mentally retarded and lives in a state home in the central Illinois area. My ex refuses to pay for the expenses that are not covered by the home, like certain clothing and certain food and certain necessities. I take her out during the week, and I tip the people who take care of her. Is this something that I can force my ex to contribute to? And the answer is yes. When you have an adult disabled child, the Illinois law specifically says that you can make your ex pay for contribution to those expenses. It's just like child support in a way. But the fact that a daughter is living in a home means that most of the expenses are probably covered, like meals and room and board and furnishings and heat and electricity and water. Those things are generally covered by the state. And Social Security benefits, for the girl probably has Social Security benefits, that will go directly to the state home to compensate them for some of the costs attendant to taking care of her. But for those extra expenses, we call those extraneous expenses, that is something that you could go to court and ask the judge to have your ex contribute to, and you would have to then document, this is the average I spend on clothing, this is the average I spend on commissary items or tips, which is a very common thing that you do in these kinds of places like Misericordia. You will tip the staff or you donate to the staff, and that those are things that are very, very common, and the judge has the authority to force that contribution. You should also think about having a trust for your daughter. So when you pass away, your daughter would be taken care of with some of the money, hopefully, that you'll put into it. And you can also ask the judge to have your ex contribute to that trust, or to at least put some money into it on a monthly basis so that when both of you pass, she will have access to that money to make sure she's taken care of. So those are very important issues, and the judges are pretty good at making sure that adult disabled children are taken care of. Anyway, we're going to be continuing to take your legal calls, and then we're going to do a little conversation about pardons and commutations. As you may remember from this week, President Donald Trump is talking about giving some sort of commutation to our former governor, Rod Blagojevich, which would shorten his sentence, and perhaps pardon Martha Stewart from her felony for perjury. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to do a little quiz on the famous commutations and pardons over history. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN.
I've got this thing, and it's fucking golden.
The problem's with us, Slammy Fence Rod said to me. I am not guilty if you ignore me, Galatees. I was just raising cash to run for the presidency. There must be 50 ways to impeach a governor. I said it's really not my habit to be rude, but your hair resembles something in a Cajun refugee suit. And the wiretaps I heard said he screwed you, should have shifty ways about your governor.
Okay, well, I wonder who wrote that. Could that be a Karen Conti creation? Could it be a parody? I should have checked with my entertainment lawyer to make sure that that wasn't a violation of some sort of copyright law. But I do know that you can parody songs, and that's something that I did a while ago, which was a lot of fun. Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about impeachment and commutation. This is the issue that President Trump was talking about, pardoning Martha Stewart and commuting the sentence, the 14-year sentence that our former governor Rob Blagojevich was given. And while I talk about it, I would really like to hear your thoughts on this. Do you think Trump will do it, number one? Do you think that he should pardon Governor Blagojevich? And if you were Governor Blagojevich and you got out of jail, what would you do? What would be the first thing you do, and then what would you do for the rest of your life? What would be the natural progression of his life after that? I was thinking that myself, and I was coming up with some really kind of crazy ideas. But give us a call here while I'm talking about this. I would love to hear from you. What do you think? Should he be pardoned or commuted? And is Trump going to do it? And what is going to happen to our beloved former governor? 981-7200 or text us at 981-7200. I'm going to give you what I call the quick clemency 101. Clemency is the broad category that encompasses a number of different tools that a president or a governor has in these kinds of things. It's the term that encompasses pardons, commutations, and amnesty being probably the least used tool. And that is, amnesty is the granting of forgiveness to a class of persons who may have violated the law. So a very well-known amnesty was when there were draft dodgers and there was a commutation or an amnesty for restoring, basically saying that even if you ran to Canada, you will not be prosecuted. So that was a blanket amnesty. And back in the old days, there was a granting of rights to Confederate soldiers who fought to reinstate their voting rights. So that was another very kind of public amnesty that was granted by the president. Commutation is really just a shortening. It's a shortening of the sentence. It means the sentence is over, and there can also be some provisions and conditions on that. So let's just say that President Trump said, all right, Blagojevich, you're not pardoned, which means you're still a felon, which means you still can't vote, you still can't buy a firearm, you still maybe can't own a business, because those are things that you might not be able to do with a felony conviction, but you're out of jail. And he could, if he wanted to, attach some conditions, like you can't run for office if you get out, or you have to stay in the state of Illinois, or something that he could put as a condition. A pardon is a full relief. It's full relief. It's as if you never had a conviction, complete forgiveness. So then again, you can buy your firearm, you can sit on a jury, you can vote, and you can do the things that people who aren't felons can do. The Constitution specifically gives the president a right to do it. It's right in the Constitution. You know, it's interesting that people are talking about how controversial this would be. People always talk about how controversial pardons are, but they're all controversial, but they're all perfectly legitimate. There's nothing illegal about giving someone a pardon or a commutation, and as much as you may not like it, the president clearly has the right to do it. But the president can only do it for federal crimes, and the state governor can do it for state crimes. And so basically that's, you just learned everything I know about commutations and pardon. They're hard to get. I have drafted pardon petitions and commutation petitions for the state of Illinois. I did one federal one. I did one in upstate New York. And you put in there all the reasons why this person should have their crime pardoned, all the good work they've done, all the people who support them, maybe, you know, the reasons that these things happen in the first place. They're very rarely granted, and when they are, it's a huge relief. But give us a call here, 981-7200. Tell me, do you think Trump is going to do it? Should he do it? And what's Blagojevich going to do? Let's go to the lines. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. What do you think?
Oh, hello, Karen.
Hi.
I think that I'm a Republican. If I was on the jury on that, I'm not in Cook County, so I would never have been called. But if I was on the jury, I would vote not to convict Governor Blagojevich. There's so much shenanigans and horse trading going on in the political field. It's unbelievable. Make your head spin.
So in your opinion, he didn't cross the line that anyone else.
No, I don't think he did. And when you get the full weight and power and financial capability of the federal government against you, and you've got to fight it as a person, as a one person, you can't fight.
You're absolutely, Jeff. You're right about that.
You're going to get crushed.
Thank you for the call, Jeff. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I think that's a great point, and that even for people who are very wealthy and people who are very powerful and who attract good lawyers like Blagojevich did, he had really great lawyers, it's still an awesome task to go up against the federal government. They hardly ever lose. In fact, most people plead guilty to avoid a trial. Let's go to Joe. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. What do you think? Do you think President Trump is going to do it?
I think he's going to do it, and I think that Governor Rod Blagojevich deserves to be pardoned. He didn't really commit any crime. He didn't steal any money, and I don't even think he intended to steal any money, but he talked too much. He was just talking all the time, and you could tell by the mannerisms that his wife was going through. She was always pulling his arm, trying to stop him talking.
Yes.
I'd like to say is that, Look at what the Jackson family, Jr. And his wife, what they did, and they actually stole money, and they got pardoned after less than a year in jail. I mean, what's this?
They served a very short time. You're right, and they did. Their problem was that they took their campaign contribution money and didn't pay taxes on it. And you're right. When you compare and contrast some of these things, it just doesn't seem fair. One last question before I move. What do you think he's going to do if he gets out? What do you see him doing? Well, Joe.
I think he's going to just be quiet. He's learned his lesson, and he's going to lead a normal, good life.
All right, Joe.
Well, I'd just like to say one thing. We enjoy your program so much. We're usually coming back from our home in Wisconsin, and you make our trip very short because you're so interesting.
Thank you, Joe. Where's your house in Wisconsin?
Green Lake.
Oh, beautiful. That's beautiful. We're at Delavan, so you probably run into us coming back sometimes. But that's a beautiful place. What is it called? The Heidel House?
Yeah, the Heidel House.
Yeah.
If you ever want to come up there, just let us know. You can come up and visit and stay with us.
You know, people really shouldn't invite me because I end up right. Don't do it. We have time for one quick one, and then we're going to continue this. I like this. I want to hear what people have to say. Let's go to Dick. Welcome to WGN. What do you think? Is Donald Trump going to commute the sentence of Rod Blagojevich?
He might. I mean, I'm thinking he's going to be commuting or pardoning people. It's kind of a cover for him so that people won't turn against him. You know, it's somebody like Cohen and other folks like that.
So you think he's trying to send a message to some of these other people to say, look, I have this right, I'm going to do it, and I'll do it with you if you play ball with me. Is that what?
There you go. Good old Blago. No, I tell you what, I would not want him pardoned. You know, I grew up in Chicago, very jaded and cynical. But when he tries to shake down at the children's hospital, that really offends my head.
You know, that was the one that got to me, too. That was the one I think was troublesome. And strangely, that didn't get as much press as selling the Senate seat, which to me was just him saying to people, listen, I got to get something for it because it's a valuable right I have here, and I really need to get something for it. But we all see politicians do that. It was that children's hospital that rubbed me the wrong way. Totally agree with you. But thank you for... Go ahead.
When he gets out, he'll probably write a book and make a lot of money.
He probably will write a book. Yeah, I like that. And, you know, I don't know if any station in Chicago would give him a radio show, but that man is super glib. I once watched him give a speech where he talked for about a little over an hour, not a single note, not a single ahem or haw. He was very glib. He knew statistics. He knew history. He knew baseball. He was funny. He was engaging. He was very likable. And so I could see him being maybe not on WGN, but maybe some other radio station. But thank you for the call. I appreciate it. All right. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. If you have any legal questions, call me, or you can continue this topic. I really like this topic of talking about Rod Blagojevich. And also, the third caller, I'm going to get you on the phone, and I'm going to give you a little quiz about pardons and commutations with very valuable gifts as prizes. So give us a call here, 981-7200. The third caller will come on the show and do a little quiz. You're listening to WGN. We're on our last leg here. A couple of interesting little texts. I was all for a pardon. Does he deserve jail, but that long? Trump will pardon him, with the price being that Blagojevich comes out and becomes a Trump mouthpiece. Ugh. Someone else from the 815 area code says, release Blago only if he's given a gag order so he can't blabber all over the media. That's what makes it so nice that we don't have to listen to him blabber while in prison. So I don't think that Trump could do that. I don't think he would do that. Put that condition on it, that he has to sit in his home and not talk. That would be cruel and unusual punishment. Anyway, we have a contestant here. The little quiz that I have has to do with prison commutations and pardons. Welcome to the show, Barb. You're the third caller. Are you excited?
I think so.
You sound.
I hope I know the answer.
Yeah. Well, we're going to do, it's about 7 or 8 questions, and these are
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're about famous pardons and commutations. It's multiple choice, and the winner, you're going to win if you get, I'll say if you get 3 out of all of them. Okay, that's pretty fair. You will be the winner of a Karen Conti Show hat. Yes, of your very own. Okay, here we go. Ready for the first one.
Sure.
Quote, pardon me, President Washington. We would be honored to receive the first U.S. presidential pardon for our 1794 tax protest. We are not drunks, but just passionate folks who don't like federal taxes. President George Washington pardoned the leaders of what tax protest? Boston Tea Party? The Whiskey Rebellion? The Valentine's Day Massacre? Or the raid on Harper's Ferry?
Oh, I guess the Whiskey Rebellion.
And that is correct. It was a response to a tax on whiskey, and 20 were arrested, and that was the first U.S. presidential pardon. Ready for the next one?
Sure.
All right. Pardon me, President Ford. Let me be perfectly clear about Watergate. Although I'm quaking in my boots, I am not a crook or a creep. Please save me and the country from this mess. After all, I did make you vice president. What former president did President Ford pardon? I don't think I even need to give you the choices.
Richard Nixon.
That is correct. That is correct. And at the time, I think Ford really got a lot of grief about it. But I think in the long run, it kind of looked good that we kind of were able to move our country forward without any tangled legal messes. All right. You're doing very well. Next one. Pardon me, President Clinton. Sure, I helped rob that bank, but it was only because I'd been brainwashed by the SLA. Who is this poor little rich girl pardoned by President Clinton?
Natty Hurst.
That's right. That is correct. And as you may remember, she was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army and committed some crimes. And it was really thought very widely that she was brainwashed by them and sort of took an interest in her captors. And essentially, Carter commuted the sentence, and President Clinton was the one who gave the full pardon. You're doing very well. Let's go to number 4. You already won, but we're going to keep going anyway because we're having fun.
Okay.
All right. I know you got that hat in mind right away. Pardon me, President Clinton. I deny trading with Iran or evading taxes. My ex-wife Denise misses me. Also, it's really cold here in Switzerland. Who is this wealthy guy who received a pardon from President Clinton? Bernie Madoff, Ivan Boesky, Gordon Gekko, or Mark Rich?
Was that Madoff?
No. Bernie Madoff is still in jail, as probably will be for the rest of his life. It was Mark Rich. Was indicted on illegal trading with Iran. He fled to Switzerland, and that was a very controversial pardon, as I recall it. Okay, here we go. Let's go to, pardon me, President Reagan. I admit making some ill-advised contributions to President Clinton's reelection campaign. I just didn't understand those confusing campaign finance laws. Besides, I've got to get busy planning for the next baseball season. Who was this New Yorker pardoned by President Reagan? Pete Rose, Yogi Berra, George Steinbrenner, or Mickey Mantle?
George Steinbrenner.
That is correct. Very, very, very good. All right. Let's go to, all right, pardon me, President Andrew Johnson. I am not dirty. I was just being a good doctor fixing a broken leg. I had nothing to do with the assassination. Besides, I've been saving fellow inmates while in prison. Who was this doctor pardoned by President Andrew Johnson? Samuel Mudd, Mary Surratt, John Wilkes Booth, or David Harold?
I think Samuel Mudd was a doctor.
That is correct. And do we know whether or not the phrase, your name is Mudd? Your name is Mudd. Does that come from Samuel Mudd? Does anybody know that? Do we have linguists out there?
I don't know. That makes sense, though.
It kind of makes sense. Okay, we got two more. All right, you're doing really, really well. Pardon me, President Nixon. If you pardon me for jury tampering and fraud, I promise I will not get involved in the management of any labor union. Heck, I might even just disappear.
Jimmy Hoffa.
That's Jimmy Hoffa. That's right. That was an easy one. We talked about that. All right, and the final one, pardon me, George H.W. Bush, I faithfully served President Reagan as the U.S. Secretary of Defense. Now they're charging me with lying to the independent counsel during the Iran-Contra affair. Can you please help out a good old buddy? Who was this longtime U.S. cabinet member pardoned by the first President Bush? Janet Reno, Robert McNamara, Oliver North, or Caspar Weinberger?
I think that was Weinberger.
That is correct. Barb, you are a pardon princess.
And do I get two hats?
No. All right. Should we send two hats? All right. We'll send two hats. You send two hats, and you can wear both of them or give one away to a loved one. Thank you so much for joining us, Barb. Have a great rest of your week. Take care.
Okay, thank
you. All right. So let's talk a little bit about legal issues. I would like to give out my numbers again. I think it's very important that you know that I'm always available to talk to you. If I can't answer your question, I can probably get you somebody who knows the answer to the question, and in the right county and maybe in the right price range and hopefully in the area where you are. I get a lot of calls about wills and trusts, and I do know lawyers all over the Chicagoland area who would be good for you, so I can send you a quick email. The best thing to do is send me an email, because then you can give me all the details about your issue, about your problem, telling me what it is you want, what it is you expect, when it happened, and where you are, and that will be very helpful for me in getting back to you. Or you can leave me a message. That is also another option. So let me give out that information. 312-332-7800, and my email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com.